Welcome to another episode of Late Nights with Trav and Los. I'm Trav, and you know, while I was editing this episode, I kept feeling the desire to jump in here at the top and kind of prepare you for what you're about to hear. To set the stage, I want to share a personal experience. This week I've been traveling for work. In fact, right now I'm recording this introduction in my hotel room in Tel Aviv, Israel. And as you travel around, you meet new people, you invariably talk about your personal interests and hobbies, and I end up trying to explain this podcast a lot. And, you know, we really do have a good podcast description of the show. It says something like, Late Nights is a discussion about being healthy and productive and the professional creative economy. Like this, it's a really good description. It's accurate, but it's also kind of a mouthful. And I've just defaulted to telling people that it's a podcast about creative professionalism. And I think that the interview that you're about to hear is a really great representation of that idea. A few weeks ago, Los and I were invited to the Netflix headquarters to chill with Andy Law, who is in charge of Netflix's design on mobile platforms. And he was also featured in the design documentary, Design Disruptors, produced by Envision. And so we're going to talk about the film. We're going to talk about Andy's personal journey, his struggles and triumphs. And as we do so, I would like you to continually reflect on how Andy shows us his take on creative professionalism. So this is part one of two. Please enjoy.
Late nights with Trav and Los.
This is Los here. Say Los.
Say Los.
Yeah.
Hi Los. That's Travis is pointing at me.
Yeah. We have a special guest on the podcast tonight, and his name is Andy Law. Andy, can you say hello?
Hello.
All right. So for you guys, this is the first time tuning in. You're probably here because you read Andy Law's name. And let me just give you a rundown of what Travis and Los is. It's a late night podcast. Two guys talking late in the night. And we have a special third guy talking with us tonight. So, Andy Law.
Yes.
Andy freaking Law. So we met Andy a little while ago. And then once again, recently, when we were at the Envision Design Disruptors film premiere.
Premiere in San Francisco, yeah.
What was that experience like for you?
It was pretty surreal, actually. We filmed everything kind of independently, and then to see it actually come together and to have there be like a narrative that carries through.
That was the first time you saw the whole film together?
That was the first time I saw anything outside of the trailers. Like, they'd send me a few trailer cuts just like with like glimpses of my face. I'm like, oh, okay, like that's probably all I'm going to be in the whole doc.
Right.
And I was totally fine with that, by the way. I remember recording and thinking that like everything that I'm saying is terrible, so they're not going to use it. So it was really surreal. It was great to see the amount of effort that they put into that. Like, they really cared about kind of giving something back to the design community, and I hope it's kind of a beacon that a lot of people kind of don't know that they can be designers, and I hope they see that and they're like, okay, like I can achieve that as well.
Don't know they can be designers. Talk about that. What kind of person is in your mind? Like you're describing something, obviously, yeah. Right? So, like, what is that?
So, you know, when I was a little kid, I was a little boy growing up here in the Bay Area, my parents told me I could be a doctor, I could be a fireman, I could be an engineer, whatever that meant at the time. But design was not something that was on the forefront of people's minds.
Right.
Maybe interior designer, potentially, but this really didn't exist. So, I look at, like, what we're trying to teach in schools and things like that today, and they still don't talk about design. Right. So it's really, I'm hoping that that film can be something that kids can kind of hopefully watch and consume and go, I want to do that. Or at least like pique their interest a little bit to kind of broaden their horizons so that they can become designers as well.
Well, that's interesting. Now, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but you are working at Netflix right now.
I am. We're at Netflix right now. We're recording this at Netflix.
Andy was kind enough to invite us over to the office. It's a new office, a nice new office. So I don't want to jump too ahead and talk about Netflix too much right now, but just concerning the movie that we're talking about, Design Disruptors, is an independent film produced by a startup in New York called Envision App. What do you think they would need to do in terms of distribution? That's why I'm bringing up Netflix, right?
Sure,
Netflix
is a
really great way to distribute content. What do you think Envision would need to do in order to get that film in front of that kind of persona that you're talking about, the person who doesn't know that they can be a designer?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're doing a certain amount of that, which is like they're doing a lot of these screenings. But I think we need to figure out a way to kind of get that into, you know, and in front of elementary schools.
Elementary schools,
that might not be the perfect medium. I mean, that documentary and the way that it was kind of put together and cut and everything else, I think it's for a little bit of an older audience, so potentially high school.
Mm-hmm.
But you could imagine a different cut could be very applicable to elementary schools.
Yeah.
And you have people that are designers that are looking at ways of giving back to the design community, and that could be a tool that we could use to then present that in front of elementary schools. So talking about, you know, they had mentioned in the doc about, they'd mentioned about kind of design sprints and like Google's philosophy around design sprints.
Mm-hmm.
Like you could imagine doing that with a classroom of elementary school kids,
absolutely.
And it would be a blast.
That'd be really good.
So yeah. I could like imagine what kind of problems that they want to solve through design, and walking them through that, and just kind of like lighting that initial spark.
Well, it's interesting in like the documentation of the design sprint. You know, we reference elementary educational design exercises all the time. Like there's the classic one of like the studies were done, and they gave a group of people a task to, you know, like build a tower out of the. Did they talk about this on the movie? I feel like they did. Build a tower out of the noodles, right? And they
the noodles.
Well, like some hard spaghetti noodles. You know the noodles.
I was thinking ramen, man. I was thinking ramen.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. But maybe I'm hungry. I don't know.
Joking. Get your ramen out of here. So like the noodles, right? And like in the MBAs got, you know, so far, and like they're like, what was the demographic that performed the best? It wasn't the MBAs. It wasn't like the doctorates. It was the preschoolers.
Yeah.
Because their minds were open to thinking in different ways. They didn't get caught up on their planning. They would execute, see something's wrong, and iterate.
Yeah.
And like, so what I'm trying to get to is that the idea of design is built into children intuitively,
yeah.
And we kind of hammer it out. But bringing that education and those exercises back into the classroom is something that we actually learn from as professionals from the children.
Yeah, it's a great gut check for us too, like to remind ourselves that we shouldn't be limited by technology or what we know. We should solve problems almost as if we're, you know, elementary school kids, and how they would approach something.
Right.
I have four brothers, and maybe you want to dive into this. I don't know, but
go on, yeah.
I have four brothers, and all of them are married, and all of them have kids. So mm-hmm. I have like eight nieces and nephews
mm-hmm.
of all varying ages, from like 6 months to like 10 years old. And it's really interesting my interactions with them, because, you know, the 10-year-old is all over, you know, he's playing the Minecraft and he's playing all these games.
Right, right.
And I actually learn from him about what's like going to be trending or what's going to be popular. I learn from this little kid, right? But it's also
they're a good beacon for what's next.
Absolutely. Yeah. What's next? Because, you know, like I'm sure he knew about Pokemon Go before it was like to the masses. But it's really interesting seeing them and how they solve problems. If you kind of boil design down, it's about solving problems, but in a really simple way.
Mm-hmm.
And because kids are constrained, they don't know they're constrained, but they're constrained with like the tools that they have around them.
Yeah.
They have to figure out really simple ways of solving problems. I remember doing it as a kid as well, but you're not consciously thinking, oh, I'm designing this, right? You're just like necessitating or fulfilling a need that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So I love it. I love that kind of analogy and how simple that is, and how we should all be reminded of that, and that's how we should design as well.
Right. Yeah. I like how you mentioned that. You know, before you put it in front of these kids, there could be a possible different edit, right? Because it was the movie was a little bit heady.
Yeah.
Definitely intended for adults. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest kind of sentiments that I took away, Los and I ran around. If you guys missed that episode, check out our like a few weeks ago, we did a recap of what it was like.
That's
we
right.
were running around and talking to people after. We talked to you after. And one of the most prominent sentiments that I took away is that people were like, now I know what to tell my mom.
Yeah, I can show this to my mom, and then we can talk about what I do.
Yep.
Right.
Yes.
Because it organized the idea of who we are and what our job is
yeah.
so well that, like, you know, somebody who's unfamiliar with the, you know, the terms or even the ideas would be able to say, oh, that's how you build, that's how you create. That's
we can actually like point at something and say like that's, because my mom's the same way, right? She's like, well, what should I write in the Christmas card? I'm like, well, I'm a designer. She's like, I don't know what that means. So I don't think it'll be great if I can get my hands on a copy of this thing. I'll just sit her down for an hour and be like, okay,
completely agree.
This is what I do.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's like Uncle Andy's enjoying the weather in Los Gatos.
Yeah, I think that's what she knows. I wear like flip flops to work and like t-shirts. I think she thinks I'm like maybe a drug dealer or something. Like, how do I make good money? But I don't. I have so random like hours. So yeah, it's just really good. Yeah, crack.
This stuff is the best on the street. It's having a good year. Cool. So the experience we were talking about, the being in the movie and seeing yourself on this 50-foot screen. I imagine you're familiar with a lot of the other people. You see you're filmed in isolation. It wasn't a collaborative thing with others?
It was not collaborative. I didn't know really what we were going to talk about in advance. I was kind of nervous going into that whole experience. Because
was the production for you just one day, like a come in?
It was like 5 hours. Like, we did it at the old Netflix office. It was like 5 hours. Yeah, that's a long time.
Well, so, I mean,
that's in front of a camera.
That's in front of a camera.
When's
the last time you interviewed and you went through the gauntlet of being interviewed by 5 different people, 6 different people, and you're there 6 hours, right?
Well job
right. That's right.
That's what I'm saying.
That's kind of what I associate.
Now put a camera in front of you while you're doing it.
Right.
Yeah. And so it was stressful, but yeah.
Yeah, no, the only correlation I have is we were making a promo video at one of the startups I was in, and they sat me down and they're like, so what do you do, or why is this company great? And I was like, when you do turn the camera on, especially like if you, how do I say this? If you didn't write the script, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I do a lot of YouTube and stuff, and I control the whole narrative. It's all me, so it's easy.
Yeah, you know where you're going.
Right.
Yeah.
So being fed prompts by somebody and having to react on your toes, flip-flops or none, it's going to be... I could see how that'd be a little bit like 5 hours of anxiety,
and I knew that it was going to be a big deal because I knew the type of production value that they were going to do. I knew that they were going to do something really great, and I knew some of the people that were going to be in it, like John and I think and Julie. They had mentioned some of that stuff that they'd already filmed. So for me, I had a lot riding on my shoulders because I work with a lot of talented people here, and I wanted to represent us very well.
Right,
I didn't want to say something stupid. I didn't want to say something out of turn. Or like appear that we like were cocky or anything else.
Right.
again, like I'm not only representing myself, I'm representing all these other great people that we get to work
with.
That's
right.
They were telling us that their whole production was almost on the order of 2 years or something, right?
Yeah, it was about 2 years, and initially it was only going to be like a 10-minute like customer story.
Yeah.
And then it becoming a documentary.
It's called snowballing.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking to
it's called Scope
to Clark
Creep.
And I was like, that's feature creep, bro.
Yeah.
So when in those 2 years, like, did you record your piece relatively recently, or was this like
no? That was like a year and a half ago. I'd only been at Netflix for like 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And they like I honestly don't know. They just kind of randomly reached out to me. I don't know. Maybe they had an interview that I'd done, or I have no idea.
Yeah.
But they reached out to me and kind of gauged my interest, because if you look at the documentary, a lot of those people are. They're VPs, they're directors.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm one of maybe two, you know, IC types at the time,
right.
To be in that documentary. So it was a big deal for me. And I wanted to make sure again that I was representing Netflix and and the rest of, you know, my colleagues in the best light that I could.
And just for clarity, IC means individual contributor.
Contributor,
which
yes.
means it's not a manager.
Yes.
You're creating pixels.
You're actually creating things.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's really interesting. It's interesting to, like, I feel like Lois, you and I have been talking about this product, this movie, for a while, right?
Yeah.
We did the thing, we did the recap of it. Envision just, like, republished the recap, which was cool. And now we're talking to you about it now.
Yeah, and there was the planning stage, too.
The planning
stage? Where we talked about planning out how we were going to do the Facebook live stream.
Yeah, it's been on our collective minds for quite a while, and this is an interesting take on it, seeing like what your involvement was and like behind the production of the actual film and stuff like that. That's interesting. I didn't know that it was that long ago that they contacted you.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, you know, I sat on stage after the premiere, right, for the interview, and I have a you know, pretty full beard, I'll say.
You've been growing out for 2 years.
I've been growing out for two solid years. That's the only thing I've been doing, selling crack and growing my beard out. I really, now you have to keep in the crack part or else it's not going to make sense.
I see means something individual crack distributed.
There you go.
So, okay, well, let's take it back then. I mean, that's a really great shock into what you've been doing today. Let's reverse back. You said you had four brothers?
I have four brothers, yep.
Okay. And where do you fall in that stack?
I'm the youngest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So you've got, like, a lot of living up to do? Is it, like, so I was actually, yeah.
I don't know what that means.
I'm getting
he's got his own agenda
he's
here.
Got, he's leading. He's
I'm
leading.
I'm getting into it.
All right, pulling the gloves off.
Yeah. Right. Well, I had a conversation today with somebody else, and we were talking about, you know, what types of people do your
order. Yeah.
What does it mean? Like what are some things, if we look at all of the secondborns, all of the firstborns, what can we tell about them, you know? And my wife was reading to me a while ago this study that was saying, like, firstborns are usually, like, highly motivated. They're also, like, if they fail, it's crushing to them.
Yeah.
Because, like,
so they're more cautious as well.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. So being the youngest of four or of five?
Of four.
Yeah. Okay. So you have three.
Yes.
Okay. We're learning to count today also. being the youngest, are any of your other siblings in creative fields? Or
not at all, no.
Tech or anything like this?
So my oldest brother, how that like pecking order kind of falls.
Yeah,
is
yeah.
That I think the firstborn in my family is very smart, but like I mentioned, he's cautious. Right? Then the secondborn is the black sheep.
Yep.
That's how that falls normally.
Yeah, I'm a black sheep.
Then the third is like even more cautious and kind of more family oriented for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Family oriented, yeah.
And then the fourth, in my case, is like I'm the creative one, but I had to be creative because when you're around four boys and everyone's like, you know, you're kind of scrounging for food around the table. You have to figure your shit out. So for me, I had to be witty. I had to be quick.
Were you funny?
Yeah. Well,
you're the funny one.
Yeah, I'm hilarious.
Yeah, I'm so funny.
I'm asking the real so questions. Funny. Like, not to brag, guys, but I'm a really funny guy.
Yeah, I'm super hilarious.
Well, no, like humor is you often find it with young ones and also people who have like kind of like stressful homes.
Mm.
And I don't want to imply anything, but you find this where people will learn to be funny to relieve the stress. Now maybe it's, you know, one or other, maybe it's just the stress of having three other older brothers who are taking all the chicken soup. Yeah. You know, I don't know what it is, but I think
he's like back to like the ramen already.
Yeah,
like so you take the noodles, right? The noodles.
So for me, I think like I used, you know, self-deprecating humor a lot to deflect. So like when I, you know, my brothers were picking on me for some reason, I would kind of get to the punchline before they could,
right.
And that would take the steam away from them or out of them. So I've kind of, you know, but in a way still I was like solving problems. I was like social problems,
sure.
But I still was doing that. So, I think that like wit and humor have gotten me into and out of a lot of trouble over the years.
Do you think that wit and humor have added to your design makeup? And if so, how?
I think it probably plays its kind of, like a trace role or something like that. Like I don't look to it and be like, you could see my humor in that design, right?
Like,
maybe my boss could. Like, he's like, that looks like shit.
Yeah.
And he sees the humor in that. But I think for me, I use it. I use it again in social situations, especially around work, because I find that like I want to work in a fun environment. I want to work where we're all kind of like buddy and having a good time. So I use my humor whenever I can to kind of diffuse tension in situations. And I think that like I think it makes a lot of sense in kind of the world of Netflix. Right, we're an entertainment company. Like we're not making medical devices. If we fuck up today, no one's gonna die. You might not have a great night, or you might, you know, something might crash on you. But again, you're not gonna die. So for us, it's really about having that kind of that fun environment. And I had identified that going into the interview too. Like I was kind of joking around with Todd Yellen, who's you know, really high up here at Netflix. When I went into the interview, I didn't know who he was.
Okay.
But we had this kind of banter and rapport right off the bat, and he uses humor in a similar way. So right away I was like, oh, like, okay, I could work here. Like, yeah, I get cool. that. Like, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That's good.
You know, I like that how when I asked about bringing humor into your work, your go-to answer wasn't about like, oh yeah, you have to be fun with your designs. You're talking about how you relate to other people mm-hmm. and how like humor is a mechanism by which you're kind of understanding the other people's situations and being able to play off of it, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think you see that in a lot of comedians are able to in a lot of ways comedians are like a reflection of our society, right? Like they
yeah.
have like this they can tap into that like conscious the mistakes that we make or like the way that we misunderstand or understand what's going on around us and then be able to turn it back into us, and that's why it's funny.
Yeah.
But in a way a designer has to do a similar thing, right? Mm-hmm. We have to kind of understand society as a whole and reflect it back to them and say, this is what we think that you need.
We're closet comedians. And
Closet comedians.
Trademark, TM. 2016.
Great. Okay, so as a child, we have someone who you say is resourceful. What were the words you used? Or something?
Barefoot.
Barefoot.
Well, okay, sandals, guys.
Sandals.
Yeah.
Not a total hippie.
We're talking about like rainbow sandals. Like I look more like a surfer. I look like a homeless surfer.
Quality sandals. Quality. Come on. Yeah.
They're cozy.
No, I would say that you know, I was kind of quick to diffuse situations,
yeah.
and I try to be quick and witty, really.
Nice.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing a looking into your career, like your resume,
mm-hmm.
I'm seeing early work in like marketing as opposed to design.
Yep.
And I'm interested in how that plays into like that, you know, that wittiness and the like, because marketing is all about, right, like understanding what the lack is and twisted into the need, right?
Yep.
So can you tell me about why did you start with marketing and how it led into design?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, I think this kind of like harkens back to the fact that I didn't really know that design was an option. Mm-hmm. I knew what a graphic designer was, but I didn't know what a product designer was.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
not even sure like that role had really solidified.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when I was in high school, the closest thing that I could identify to like being creative and having kind of a business angle was marketing. I've always, like, my dad had a pretty successful business here in the Bay Area. I grew up, like, after school, like, when I was little, I would like, go to his office, like, hang out, and I gravitated towards the marketing people.
Was that a marketing business?
No, not at all. It was actually a document imaging solutions company, which basically today means scanners.
Yeah.
Yes, thank
okay.
you. So he sold and distributed these huge, like, pallet-sized
right.
scanners at the time. This is, you know, 90s,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So I hung out at the office all the time, and I would kind of gravitate towards the marketing people because I liked what they were doing. I didn't know why I liked it. I liked how they were positioning the product. And
were your siblings doing similar things, coming to the office and hanging out?
No, not at all.
Interesting.
They're off kind of, you know,
gallivanting.
Yeah, they're gallivanting. I don't think any of my brothers have ever gallivanted.
I just love that word.
Were they gallivanting? Be honest. It was gallivanting, wasn't it?
There might have been a little gallivanting.
So you kind of wandered in alone and you found camaraderie with the marketing people.
Yeah, and there were only two of them, so maybe that's like it wasn't intimidating, and I really liked spending time with them, and I think it was the fact that they were.
And we're talking high school age?
No, this is I would say even earlier than that.
This
is probably junior high, maybe end of elementary into junior high.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, 6th, 7th, 8th grade.
Started young.
Mm-hmm.
And I like even back then, like they were like they didn't produce any of the materials themselves, but they worked with agencies to do that stuff. And so I would go in there, and there'd be like art on the walls, and there'd be like
oh fun,
like all this stuff that as a kid you're just like oh like that's art. Like I do art too,
yeah,
right? Like
yeah.
I draw stuff. I'm a terrible artist, by the way. So I gravitated towards that stuff, and it really kind of, I think that led me into going into college and saying that I want to do marketing, or at least I thought I want to do marketing.
So you did a marketing program at San Jose.
I did, yeah. And they have a design school, which is
yeah,
really funny.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't, yeah. So I went to San Jose State for, yeah, I have a business administration and marketing degree.
That's awesome.
Nice.
That's yes. awesome. Yeah, no, when I saw San Jose, I just thought it was the design program, but you went there for marketing.
Went there for marketing, yeah.
Right. And then so when did you do your internship? 1998. Where was that at?
What does it say on my resume?
Wait, what story am I telling?
Well,
yeah.
Isn't that funny? Like everybody has like a few different slices of the story.
Depending yeah,
on what
yeah.
you want them
well,
to
how long are you calling back to? Like you said 1990.
I'm just looking at your LinkedIn, and I'm thinking,
is it like, Levitt Pacific? What's the company?
I lost it here. Oh, we have one at Lost Cypress.
Oh, that's my dad's company. That was his company.
Yeah. So you interned at your dad's company, or does that just mean I went and hung out with the market?
I probably went and hung out. I'm going to count that as an internship. I probably got some credits for that.
Okay. I'd count it as an internship, right?
I love it. I have two diverging paths I want to take right here. So first one is being able to mark the ridiculous things we do when we're, you know, use or discovery as actual work experience. I just want to kind of like commend you for this because like I can't tell you like how many like times when I first started out they're like, okay, so how many years experience? You're like, well, like 7-8 years of freelance, because like who can check that?
Yeah. So like, I made a post here in like 1992, right?
That counts.
It went on my mom's fridge.
Exactly. Yeah. That's freelance.
Was
like that.
She was a client. She paid me my allowance. That's work.
And the other road I wanted to take, just for a moment, just a little sidetrack, is I got a question recently, somebody asking about how important is it that someone's able to like draw and kind of like paint and things like that, be an artist, air quotes, dick fingers, yeah. To be a designer. And you mentioned that you're not a great artist. Can you talk about this?
So yeah, I could go back to, I think I did two classes in high school that were art classes, mm-hmm. and I passed them, but my personality got me past those things, not any of the work that I did. I would always like bond with teachers. Like okay. That was my goal more than anything else, was to build rapport with teachers. So yeah, I'm a terrible artist. Like I remember the one thing that I really enjoyed doing was doing like isometric stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that had, it was because it was more about like lines and precision.
Right.
And I did in like eighth grade, I took a drafting class, like not CAD, because I don't think like CAD existed, but like no one had access to it.
Computer aided drafting.
Yeah. But back then it was actually like you had your kind of like big board with your paper and your rulers. And we had an awesome teacher that kind of inspired us to kind of do CAD CAD stuff, mm-hmm. with just pens and rulers. So we would start doing that stuff. So I think that's why I was somewhat good at isometric, and it's still like a lot of the stuff that's on my dribble is kind of calls back to that side of the art.
Interesting.
But then when I finally got my hands on a computer and I opened like Photoshop, it just made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something, it's interesting because my brain doesn't translate very well to like my hands. Right. I'm not even really good at writing just in general.
Right.
But if you put a computer in front of me, I'll figure it out. Right.
Yeah.
And I'll teach myself, and I can, you know, there's something about it too, that like, if I waste a bunch of pieces of paper, I feel bad. But like a Photoshop, like artboard, I don't care.
Yeah,
I know exactly how you feel. I always had a hard time working in sketchbooks. I needed disposable printer paper to draw anything in, and you know what I mean?
That's what happened with it. Like I'd get same thing. I'd get sketchbooks and I'd be like,
I can't
touch it.
Yeah, you'd almost want to like do the stuff on the 8.5 by 11 like printer paper. And then once you nailed it, then go.
Yes.
Cause it's almost like a designer's diary or something.
Story of my life.
I started binding them. Like gathering all my loose leaf paper and just taking it to Kinko's and like, can we put like some huge staples in this?
Yeah.
it was good. And I had this one, and I went in there eventually and I gave them a ream of paper and I said, can you bind this?
Yeah.
And it was like this junk paper, and I felt so comfortable with it. I could draw anything and it wouldn't matter. Throw it away.
Okay.
But with these nice, you know, people spend, oh, this is nice. It's printed. Like I got a notebook. We had like this thing at work, and it's like pressed logo into it. And I'm like,
I can't touch that. No.
Right.
You'll never use that.
Right. Oh my goodness.
So I think if I grew up when like, you know, they had the iPad or something, I think that I would have tried to become more of an artist. Because again, like that's that disposable forum.
Mm. Where digital, I could just, digital art and like Command Z, you know, it's just like
just creating a canvas.
Yeah, my life is about Command Z.
Yeah.
That's a good quote.
Yeah.
My life is about Command Z. I want to talk with you a little bit about how you said that your personality got you past your art classes.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about...
And all of college.
And all... Okay, so this is interesting. So Los and I talk about professionalism in the creative workplace, and a lot of what we talk about is not like how to move a pixel around. We talk about how to discuss your work, how to discuss and talk and present and collaborate and work with people. So how does being able to... My personality got me past it. That's what I wrote.
Yep.
How does having a good personality...
Well, let me correct you there. Command Z that.
I'm doing it IRL.
Yeah. I'm not going to say that I have a good personality. Mm. I'm just going to say that.
I said that. You said your personality got you past it.
Yes. And I didn't say that it was good.
My what is it? What were your early sentiments? Your resourcefulness or your wittiness or something? That got you past it.
Yeah.
So tell me about how having a personality that, good or bad, gets you past it. How does that work?
So I think that, we can get really personal here. So I have dyslexia.
Let's do it.
And when I was a little kid, like, they had identified that I had dyslexia, and they wanted to put me in like a special class, and they wanted to kind of give me like all these other resources that they thought I needed. But I just wanted to be like everybody else.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I had my friends that were in like the normal classes. So I didn't feel that I needed to go into this other thing. So I worked really hard when I was young to try to, you know, solve my own issues, right? So, you know, there's varying degrees of dyslexia. I'm one of those people that if I see a number really quickly, some of those digits are probably flipped around.
Mm-hmm.
I can still read and everything else. But
sure.
So I think that a lot of schoolwork intimidated me, but I had to figure out a way to get around it, not to not do it, but a way to kind of level the playing field.
Mm.
And I think that I used my personality whenever I could to create relationships, because I knew that I was going to hit bumps in the road, but I could rely on those people that I'd created rapport with to get me past those bumps. And that oftentimes were teachers. So I still know some of my teachers today that, you know, from elementary school and high school, that I built these really strong relationships with, because it was out of necessity, right? Genuinely, I liked the people.
Yeah.
I wasn't like false or anything, but I would rely on those people to kind of, again, level the playing field so that I could kind of feel like a normal kid and get past that stuff. So, that's how I use it.
Do you see that?
We got so deep. Do we have tissues in here?
We actually do.
Yeah. Single tear.
Get back in there.
suck back up.
Do you see that tendency surfacing now in your professional life?
I think, again, that there's elements of that play into it. But what I wasn't able to do when I was younger was identify what I was doing, right? Like, I was kind of going through the motions, and it happened to work out in my favor, but it wasn't calculated. I didn't really know how to execute correctly on it.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I'm how old am I? I'm 31. Mm. So now that I'm 31, I can actually look at that and go, okay, well, in this situation, I, you know, said this or did this, and that didn't work out so well for me, right? So I can almost like A/B test kind of these things that work and these things that don't work. And again, like, I think that can kind of sound like it's a little bit fake, but I really don't think it is. And I think that even though I'm calculated in my business relationships, they're all genuine relationships.
Sure. Yeah. That's interesting. And I just kind of want to underscore that, you know, what makes Andy Law a professional? What makes him a successful professional? Is it completely because he has a really nice dribble layout, you know, like, you know what I mean?
Right. No, that's not it. No.
like there's more to it. There's more to each of us.
Right.
And if you think that you are a summary of your hard skills, then you're mistaken.
Yeah.
And I think this is a great example of someone using the skills that they do have to leverage and even compensate for some of the shortcomings that they all have.
Yeah, I think a lot of what I do is compensation, right? So I'm compensating for the fact that I'm not the best visual designer. I know that. I'm not the best motion designer. I absolutely know that too. Like, my life is basically a series of cups that I've learned from to get me where I am today. And not to say that where I am is where I want to be or anything else, right? Like, I always aspire to have more, to do more. Yeah, what was the question?
No, we're just talking about about your tactic. I think it's very good. I think it's not only is it obviously a successful tactic, and even saying the word tactic maybe sounds a little bit scrupulous, right? But what I'm saying is, like, Frida's listening at home. Andy is teaching us something extremely valuable here, and what that is that when someone relies on their whole skill set, hard and soft, of course Andy's a talented creator, but the way that he interfaces with the people around him and is able to gather their trust using the skills that we discussed earlier that have been with you since birth, that's really what makes Andy Law successful.
I'm nodding my head.
He is.
Fervently.
A lot of nodding over there.
No, it's good, right? That's the takeaway is... a lot of young creators are, what software do I need to use, and how do I get, you know,
yeah,
a license to that?
That we get a lot.
That's what we get a lot. It's like, hey, how do I get it? How do I get that Dribbble invite? Like, it doesn't matter.
It's yeah. Sometimes, how do I get a Dribbble invite? Be a good person. Yeah. And like, no, who can hear that?
Or annoy the crap out of somebody. Yeah. Just to shut you up. Yeah. I mean, I think that the things that have made me, and I'm using air quotes here, successful, is that I try to understand the business that I work for, and also kind of, you know, the end user or member or whatever else you want to call them, as well. And I try to walk that kind of gray area of who I'm serving, because I want to make sure that I have a job. So I want to make sure that I'm doing things that are going to increase the bottom line, right? Identifying opportunities in the product.
Right.
But at the same time, like, you can't do that and piss off your members, because then you're going to hurt your bottom line.
Is that what you guys call them here in Netflix? Members?
Yeah, they're members. Okay. Us. So that's cool. Kinda, yeah. Anytime I hear like user, I'm like, wait, oh yeah, yeah, member.
Yeah, members. Like, that's like cool. That. Yeah.
What do you call them at Atlassian?
I don't know what they call them, because I always think of them as a customer.
Customer.
Anywhere that I've been, I've forced myself to think of them as a customer, not a user.
I mean, it's all nomenclature.
It is nomenclature.
But it's interesting, like, to make the distinction is a conscious choice.
It is, and you assign a value to it, right?
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
absolutely a value assigned
and
to
so,
it.
Yeah. And so assigning it to member or customer over user, it's easier for you to see a clearer path towards empathy.
We call them at Google, we call them BFFs, so I'm just saying.
I'm just saying.
So you guys are like all the way bottom.
It's probably better than what you guys call.
You're like, you drank the Kool-Aid. He's riding the bikes.
I'm the right here, Trev. I was like, how's it going with whatever he was doing? He's like, oh yeah. He's like, I drink the Kool-Aid though.
Yeah,
I do. I'm a Kool-Aid drinker.
Yeah,
down.
You work
dirty.
For perks.
Yeah. I do.
You do. You're
like, feed me, and I'll work for like 20 cents an hour. I don't care.
And squirt water up my butt.
What, they have bidets?
Yeah,
we got bidets here. If you want a bidet?
Oh, it'll be challenging bidets. I have one at home.
Oh, okay, that's too much information.
So, hey, listen, everybody,
just get him a super soaker.
just installed it.
Yeah,
it'll work. I swear. Yeah. Everybody, this is a happy bum is a clean bum.
I don't think anybody's. Infer- no one is like debating you on that. And moving on.
And. Where were we? Okay, so we're talking about Andy's life, and you started an internship in 1998.
Apparently.
We're like, I hung out at my dad's office.
I'm probably like ate jelly beans or something.
But I'm also seeing here your next kind of job was a position at an insurance place.
Yeah.
What was the name of that?
It was Levitt Pacific at the time.
Levitt Pacific. Yeah. And that was in 2007. But I'm also seeing a few other things happening in 2007. 2007 looked like a big year for you.
Big year, yeah.
Owner and designer of Creative Swell.
Yep.
And chief creative officer at Ideation.pro.
Yep.
You did Creative Swell for 5 years and chief creative officer at Ideation.pro for 6 years, while also going on to work at other places like webagencies.com and Volt.
Yep.
So the question I have is... Yeah, what?
Like, so you're dissecting my timeline here.
Yeah, I'm looking at the timeline. Like, you're obviously overlapping here.
Yeah.
What? Why? And how? And what was the point of that?
So, especially at that time in my life, I'm the type of person where my brain doesn't shut off.
Mm-hmm.
So, my most creative time sometimes will be at like 2 or 3 in the morning.
Right.
And so I just basically stacked the deck, and I was learning about what I wanted to do. So, did I want to own my own business? Did I want to own like a graphic agency that like made poster art and stuff like that, which is what Creative Swell really did?
Okay.
Did I want to do something that kind of serviced clients, which is what Ideation Pro did? I really wanted to call those things and have them broken apart.
Yeah. So
I didn't know whether one was better than the other, so I just kind of had them separated.
Were you still proprietor, or was it with a?
Both of those, I just owned. They were. Not NDAs. What do they call when you're just doing business as DBAs?
Okay.
Yeah. So just sole props. Yeah. I my dad always owned a business, so I was like, oh, I want to do that. Like, I had a good role model to kind of look to.
Right.
So
okay.
I was like, I want to do that, and you know, it was you take out an ad in a paper and you like that's it, and then you have a business, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just super simple. So I was like, I just was like creating companies right and left. but during that time as well, like I wanted so in, especially in 2007 when I graduated college in 2008. I was doing marketing. So when I worked at Levitt Pacific, it was about like applying the skills that I was learning.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I won't say bad things about San Jose State. Like, it was fine as far as an education goes, But had I to do it all over again, in hindsight, you know, 2020, mm-hmm. I probably would not have gone to college at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't think marketing led me into design.
Okay.
I think that, like, I kind of fell backwards into marketing because I didn't know what else to do. And then when I saw design, I was like, that's it.
Okay.
Like, you I want to do that.
It immediately?
Yeah. The creativity fit, the business aspects fit.
What was the object that you saw? Somebody doing design? You saw design in a book? What was it?
It was the application of design for a business. So it was like, it was basically through like the insurance company and stuff. It was people producing ads and other things to get people excited about an insurance product.
Right.
Okay. Which is just, as we all know, super sexy.
Right.
Buy my insurance.
Yeah. So like I saw that and I was like, well, like who did this? Like who was the person that put this together?
Okay.
And at the time, I'm going to totally name drop here. Like no one's going to know this guy and he works in like a tiny little office in Utah. This guy's name was Cordell Morris and he was the guy that had Photoshop and he was the guy that was producing these things for the company. It's like a huge company and there's like one guy doing all
this
stuff.
He's the design department.
He's the design, yeah. So I like emailed him and I was like, that's really cool. Like what programs are you using? And he's like, oh, I'm using Photoshop.
That's,
I'm like,
that's the question, right?
That's the question.
Right? That's
because you're a young creative.
Yeah. You don't know what else to ask though. You really, you don't know what you don't know.
Okay. Here's a good question. What, you know, with hindsight, what should you have asked?
That's a really good question.
Would anything that's, that have been better? Question. Would any, like it is
know, that the right question to ask when you're a young question? Creative?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the wrong question to ask is the one that I asked, which is, like, what tools do you use?
Okay.
I think that's fair to be in kind of that, you know, to ask that question at some point is
fine.
Sure,
sure.
But I think that the question that I would have asked now is, like, are you happy doing this?
Oh.
Like, I would have, because you see people that, like, do things for, like, 40 years, right? Like, not so much, like, millennials. They kind of will, you know, skip jobs and hop around and kind of, you know, they're still living at home and they're 35 and they're figuring shit out, right? But neither of you live at home, right?
No.
I live in a home.
In a home, not at your childhood home.
No.
So I think for me, it would have been helpful to identify if someone was really like passionate still about their job and how long they've been doing it. So I probably would ask questions more around like the happiness aspects than anything else.
Okay. Do you have, Andy Law, are you happy?
I'm probably the happiest I've ever been in my entire life.
That's great to know.
Yeah.
So those rainbow flip-flops.
So you email Cordell, you ask him what does he use, how does that transition you into being a producer of work?
So yeah, so he said that he uses Photoshop and I was like, well, what's Photoshop? Like I like Adobe is like a block from my parents' house, right? And I'm like, what's Photoshop? So
I love that.
Yeah. Like I should have known, right? Yeah. So, you know, I hear about the program. I go online. I rip a copy, of course. Uh-huh. It's like, I don't have like $1,000 or whatever it costs. Yeah. There's no way.
I think this is a sidebar. Do you think like this subscription business model of Adobe
the Creative Cloud has...
It's robbing their next generation of customers?
That's a good question. It is a huge possibility.
Because the only reason I'm a creative professional is because I stole Photoshop.
Same.
When I was a kid.
Same.
I think if they could get attribution for what we've been able to make, like salary-wise, that company would be doing way better. Like if they could get like back pay for us stealing that program from them.
I didn't. So
we're outside the statute of limitations on that, right?
I'm sure we are.
Well, no. So when I say that I stole it, I didn't use it professionally stolen. I you know, I learned on it. And then when I would work at office, like they'd have
their own thing.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so Cordell hooks you up with the idea of using software to produce digital work.
Yep.
And this is like around 2007.
Yep.
So how long is it before you're doing, you know, applying these new skills to make money?
Pretty quickly. So the funny thing is that, you know, everybody has like their little projects. Like as soon as you tell someone that you like can you understand Photoshop,
they're like, hey,
they're like, yeah, I have this, or like, could you do this, or I want to start a company and I need a logo, or so stuff like that kind of just started trickling in. And so like I think that, you know, design educations, they're great, but I think the practical application of something is that much more important, and you learn a lot through that.
That's awesome.
So I taught myself everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like I opened an art board and I was like, well, I don't even think they were called art board. I have no idea what they were called back then.
Documents back
then. Just, yeah. I opened a new document.
Yeah.
And I like got the pen tool and I started clicking around. I'm like, oh, okay, that does that, right? And then you just kind of catalog it.
That's awesome.
And then you're like, well, then you'd have a different need. So, okay, well, now I need to, like, fill the shape with something.
Right.
Or I need to, like, again, like I'm using terminology that I didn't know back then, or I'm like, I need to isolate something, right? Uh-huh. Whatever that was. And so then you just start like clicking around and figuring out, like, and I think that the stuff that I did when I was a little kid, which I love, like taking apart toasters and things like that, mm-hmm. like reverse engineering, mm-hmm. I got really good at like trying to do that stuff with Photoshop too. I'd pull in an image or something and I'd like figure out how someone created it by kind of tracing it and going over it. And then like backing up a step and be like, oh, that layer needs to go there. So
interesting.
Like I didn't really understand, like, you know, I understood physical Z space, but not like in a document or like a layer system. Yeah, so I basically would go through that stuff. And then I found, I think it was like different tutorial sites like Tuts Plus or whatever it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would see some stuff that people are making in Photoshop. And I'm like, holy crap, like that looks amazing. I want to do that.
Right.
And so I would just start going through tutorials. And I like that's how I've. Like that's why I'm at where I am today, because I started I saw something that was really interesting and I tried to figure out how someone did it.
Right.
And that really helped me to kind of learn those programs.
We get the question a lot, you know, when am I ready?
To do what? Now, today, yesterday.
Years ago. Thank you for saying that.
To do me ready.
To do what?
You're already ready,
I think that there's something interesting. Like a lot of people are waiting for someone just to say like, you have permission, right? Which is weird. And I guess it's not weird. I shouldn't have said weird. It's fine for some people to have that perspective. I've always been the person that's like, I'm just going to do it. And if it goes bad, it's a learning experience. Mm-hmm. And if it goes well, then I'll keep doing it.
It went well.
Yeah, it went well.
That's really interesting to hear you say. Because, you know, we go to school and we're told that this is the right way to do something. And then if you do it differently, even if you write about the same solution, it's wrong. And this is like kind of beaten into us, you know, like where you have to be a law-abiding citizen. This is the law. This is how you get a, you know, this is what you do. And so I completely understand the people who have problems taking, you know, initiative.
Yeah.
You're the son of a self-starting businessman. You intuitively started multiple businesses on your own just to see if they would work.
Yeah.
and now you're telling our audience, you don't need permission. Just go to it and get started.
If you need permission, I'm giving you permission.
Yeah,
it's not gonna blow up in your face. Like, I think that's one of the interesting things that I really like about this organization, like about Netflix, uh-huh. is that we look for people, and through our like recruiting process, we try to identify people that have, you know, own their own businesses and have worked at startups, because there's a different type of mentality where. Here, it's like my job as a product designer here is to find opportunities to grow the business. Mm-hmm. That's it, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of the projects that I work on are projects that I either identified myself or I worked with like our amazing people on CI, which is Consumer Insights, mm-hmm. or DEA, which is like Data Science and Engineering. And I'll work with those people and we'll uncover an opportunity, and then that'll be a project. It doesn't necessarily come like top down.
Yeah.
So you really have to have that like a it sounds like a cliche, but like the self-starting attitude mm-hmm. to just like find, like identify something and just run after it and try to solve that problem.
Right.
And so that's really like, when I say like the permission stuff, I think that really ties into like who I am today and, mm-hmm. and why I'm able to be successful in this organization, because I let go of looking for other people to kind of tell me the right direction, and I'm fine failing. I'm mm-hmm. fine. And I hate when people say like, fail fast, or like they make it this mantra where it's like you're trying to fail. Like, mm-hmm. no, don't try to fail.
Be successful.
Like, try to be successful, mm-hmm. but it's okay if you fail as long as you learn from it.
Mm-hmm. I think that mantra is an overcompensation for a society that I just described, where we're taught so much that everybody has to color in the lines. And these are the colors that you should use, and you know, and failure. We're going to hold you back a grade. We're going to discipline you somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when people say fail fast or fail fabulous or whatever, you never
should embroider that on a pillow. No, I'm not.
I fail fabulous. That's,
there's got to be that in like an Etsy store. Somebody find that and please send it to these guys.
Is it not a thing? Is it just my
fail
thing?
Fabulous?
Fail fabulous.
No, that sounds like a show on Bravo. Never heard of that. I'd watch it, but
it's just full of people like failing fabulous.
Like falling gracefully off a stage or something.
I think those mantras are just like overcompensation. We're just trying to kick ourselves out of the mode of being followers. You know? Thank you for listening to part one of Andy's interview. I hope that you're getting as much out of these conversations with Andy as I am. His example of leveraging his strengths to overcome his weaknesses and never needing permission to try something new was just very inspiring to me. Next week, Andy tells about his unusual process of getting hired at Netflix and his efforts in mentoring the next generation of designers. Andy even goes as far as to generously invite our listeners to contact him for mentoring opportunities. So tune in to Late Nights with Trav and Los next Tuesday for part two of Andy's interview. And thank you for listening.